I liked teaching, but I didn't like the school environment, you know, or the school culture. I didn't like the idea that you had to follow a certain curriculum regardless of where the kids were. You couldn't leave your room, for example, to go to the bathroom or something, you know. You had to ask, if you really had to go, you had to ask a teacher to watch out for your class, you know. And so you kind of weren't free, it seemed to me. So one day I was glancing at the bulletin board in the office, and I saw this announcement for a child welfare and attendance worker in the district. And I read what it was saying. You would receive referrals from teachers about some kids, and you would work with families. And I said, hey, that sounds kind of interesting, you know. And so I took it, and it turned out that I made it, you know, on the first application. And so that took me out of the classroom. And so here I was working, but I wasn't in the classroom, and I was driving out in the driving out in the streets, and hey, boy, this is really neat, you know.
What was the feeling like during that time about, you know, women who were pursuing careers, and
well,
this was kind of
there wasn't very much to do about that, you know.
Did you see this normal? A lot of other women.
That was the way it was. Women, like most of the women were teachers in the lower grades. We didn't have any men, in those grades. But see, I was in the system for 34 years, and I did see change, of course, as I grew, you know, more mature, and was interested more in the issues that were happening around me and learning more. Then I became kind of observant about what was happening. I noticed, hey, this is great. There are some men coming and teaching even in the kindergarten, you know. And so, you know, that was good because, you know, kids needed to know, you know, about their fathers, you know, being, and that kind of thing. And then later on, the thing about the glass ceiling, you know, about women not being in management positions, and I was able to observe that, you know, through the times. And today, I'm even more interested now in that kind of that aspect of society today. And I'll have to tell you a story about, maybe I'd already told you. Did I tell you the story recently about my trip to France and meeting this woman mayor?
Oh, you have to tell me.
Well, I don't know if it's within the context of this thing yet.
Let's tell me at the end.
Okay.
But
like I'm saying, this becoming interested in all of these issues and things was a growth process for me, you know, my early experiences here was very, I say, immature compared to the general population, let's call it. And so this was a growing thing with me. I became more of a social worker than I became a teacher.
Were you working one-on-one with kids, or exactly what was your job?
Well, both. I was working one-on-one. Sometimes I was working with groups. We weren't allowed to give treatment per se to kids, but we worked on a kind of a short-term basis. But if we found out that this problem needed more of a therapeutic type of a casework or something, then we were trained to work with our social agencies so that we could make referrals to ongoing service, you know. Anyway, that was a very good experience for me to get involved in that kind of work. And I think that involved, if you were going to understand what was happening to kids and their families, you had to know what was happening socially in terms of social changes and things. And today I'm still very much interested in that and that kind of thing. Now what?
Well, before, sort of at the same time, you had met your husband, right?
Oh, yeah. That was in the early 40s, yeah.
How did you meet him?
Oh, brother. You know, I was at a wedding last Saturday. It was a big family wedding in San Diego. And it was a big Catholic wedding because most of the family is Catholic. The wedding ceremonies are quite long, and the priest has a lot to say, you know. This part of the wedding ceremony, in relation to your question, was out to the audience. He says, he was talking about love and love enduring and things, and then he was saying, now I want you all to recall, you know, how you first met your husbands. I said, oh no, I was ready to kick my husband out of the house. No, he wasn't my husband at the time, naturally. But the first, I was teaching already, and I was more or less not living at home as much as I used to. I was living with my girlfriend, and she was a graduate student at UCLA, and so we were living in a home. Our house was near UCLA, and she had a boyfriend. And this was around the Christmas time, I think. Or was it? No. Yeah, I think so. And, it must have been not towards Christmas, because I was teaching at the time. And, maybe near the holidays, anyway. So they were having a party, my girlfriend. And I didn't participate in the party because I was tired. I taught during the day, and I went to bed early. And so I guess the party was going along fine until I got awakened by, you know, loud noises, and sounded like something was going on in the fireplace, some kind of explosions or something. So I got upset, you know, at being awakened. So I went out, and it turned out that they had drunk too much. They were a little bit tipsy, and they were throwing firecrackers in the fireplace. And what got me so was not so much that they were having a lot of fun and everything, but I was afraid the landlady who lived right close was going to come and ball us all out. So I said, hey, what's going on here? I have to get up in the morning. I want you all to leave right now. And Bill was one of those there. So when they left, And the next day, I was talking to Josephine, and she says, you know what? Bill, who was Kermie's friend, wanted to know, who was that little girl? And so she said, that's not any little girl, that's a school teacher. And then Bill says, a school teacher? And it happened that his mother was a school teacher. So apparently that triggered him, you know, his interest or whatever. But anyhow, that week I did get a call from him, and he wanted to come and visit. And at the time, I had a long engagement going on to a fellow that I had left in the Philippines that was still kind of continuing, but was fading, you know, kind of, because he always wanted to wait until he was sure that his mother was okay and well taken care of, you know.
Was he Filipino?
Yeah, he was half Filipino. Uh-huh. His parents were Thomasites too.
Uh-huh.
But it had been going on for a long time.
Since you were 16, right?
Yeah.
When you left.
Right. We more or less said we would wait for each other.
Wow.
Well, anyway, Josephine. So he called. I think this was in, when was that? I don't know. Well, anyway, he called, and then we started dating, and I was impressed because he had so many things he liked to talk about that I kind of liked, and he liked to go on long drives, you know, and he always had a flashlight. If it started to get dark, he'd always, something interested in him, he'd want to flash the flashlight. And so I said, hey, he's kind of interesting, you know, and all these things. But in 6 months, we were married, you know. And we couldn't get our license to marry here
in
L.A. Well, we went to apply for our license to get married. And again, the same old thing, you know. Where were you born? Manila. Do you have any Filipino blood? Yes. My mother's Filipino. Well, they couldn't grant. They had the anti-miscegenation laws at that time. Those weren't repealed until 1965.
So what did you have to do?
Well, we went to Boulder City, Nevada, and got married over there.
Is that where most people went from L.A.?
I don't know. I never made a study, but anybody... anybody of color or any color in their background, they had to leave and get married someplace else. All of us married outside of California.
Your siblings, you mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So anyway,
what was Bill's profession?
Bill was studying also to be in politics, I guess in history maybe. But he had thought at one time that he would go into politics, but he never did. His uncles were Irish, and they were entrepreneurs. They established their own businesses and things, and so Bill gradually gravitated to that part, and he became more or less a carpenter, really. He specialized in building room additions, and that's what he was doing. Did very good living in that, and then of course I was teaching. And then he also became interested in addition to his building skills, he taught the kids as they were growing up, all of them, how to use tools and how to do plumbing, and how to do roofing. And the house that I showed you over there, a lot of that shows a lot of the kids' work that they did. And so that's one reason why I don't want to leave the house, you know. I want to stay there, although it's too big for me, but anyway. So it worked out just fine, because then he loved to travel, and he loved to meet people. He was a great conversationalist, you know, and he had a brain that just absorbed everything. Almost anything you'd ask him, he'd know something, and he'd go on a dissertation, you know, about it. Well, anyway, so my And then he loved to travel, so, and he had this job that he did on his own, so that whenever we had an opportunity that I had a sabbatical, then we would take off, like I showed you how we did 1 year, you know.
Tell and me what that so, was.
The what?
What you did 1 year when you were on sabbatical.
Oh, the first sabbatical that I was eligible for, the first 7 years that I taught continually, Bill and I decided that we would travel around the United States and take our kids with us. And my folks and Bill's folks said, "Are you crazy?" You know, that because one of them was only about 2 years old, you know.
How many children did you have?
We all had four. We had four. So we went all around the United States and you know, parts of Mexico that were along the border and also for Canada. And so we took 14 months to do that, you know, in a trailer. And we had great fun because we traveled on the average about 200 miles a day. And if we wanted to stay longer someplace, you know, we'd stay. And both of us would write, you know, about our experiences. I still have all the letters, you know. And we did that for three other trips that we did. We took a sabbatical every 4 years. So we used to rent our house, you know, and people said, "How could you do that?" You know, or sometimes we'd have to borrow money. "How could you do that and start all over again?" You know, well, you can do it if you want to. You know,
we're really adventurous.
Oh yeah, yeah. We were a family that did a lot of interesting things. And then Bill was very much interested in land too. You know, so he was very lucky in studying real estate and studying tax records and things like that. And usually he could predict, you know, where to buy real estate and things. So that's why we happened to have some of this property that I told you about in Hemet, you know, the ranch, which you still have today. And so that's...
Tell me, going back a little bit, when did you begin to identify... yourself as being Filipino?
Oh, yeah, okay, that's an interesting thing, too. Okay, when I finished college and was teaching, I would sometimes be assigned to a school where there were lots of blacks in the neighborhood, because the blacks were beginning to expand from the 40s, you know, where Watts was the small enclave where it was down there. They were beginning to move outward. And that was also the time when the Black Panthers and the Black Empowerment movements were taking place. And there were all these lectures about the blacks being discriminated, and they were having these community meetings about black power and the fist, you know, coming
60s.
In. Yeah. And I was very much interested in hearing that, you know. But I wasn't saying anything necessarily. I was just absorbing what they were saying, you know. "Oh, that's kind of interesting. That's interesting. I wonder why," you know, that kind of stuff. Well, the Chicanos started in on theirs. And, of course, a part of that Chicano movement was centered around the L.A. city schools. Saul Castro, I don't know if you remember that name or not. He was quite a student leader, and, you know, they had these student strikes against the schools. They weren't teaching identity and stuff like that. And the Saul Castro is now a teacher at Belmont High School. And so the Chicanos were joining the blacks. And although they were different, there were differences in their culture and things, there were commonalities in terms of the discrimination and all of that stuff. And so I was working in one of the, doing some of that social work, working with groups of kids, some of whom were groups of Filipinos, because the Filipinos were beginning to come in greater numbers now after World War II, you know, and that's when the women started coming, you know. And so naturally, you know, families were there, and so I was beginning to see more Filipino kids coming into schools, and I was getting acquainted with their families, and then more of my family was also coming over, and so we were beginning to talk about, you know, what was happening. Well, Roy Morales was working for a social agency in the same school area where I was practicing and working with troubled kids. He was working in an agency of troubled kids. And he, I got acquainted with him they had come to, not him, but his agency had come to the schools and asked for referrals of groups of kids who were troublesome and, had problems at school and that kind of thing. So I was invited to be on the board of this particular agency, which was called the Neighborhood Youth Association. So I went over and noticed this brown, colored guy, social worker. I bet he's a Filipino. And that was Roy, you know. So we got acquainted, and I made several referrals, you know, to the agency. Not only, a few Filipino kids. Usually they were kind of quiet. That was, you know, the troubled kids weren't only the misbehaving kids and the truant kids. We referred also, we recognized kids who were very quiet, kids who didn't talk much, and teachers got upset about because, you know, they wouldn't answer questions and things like that. Well, that fit the mood of the Filipino kid, you know. So Roy and I became great friends, you know, because of this commonality. And so we followed each other's career, you know, all through the years. So so that's how, you know, so he was getting involved with other Asians too, because more Asians were beginning to come. We as a group were hearing the blacks talk about their experiences. We Asians began to hear about the Chicanos, and we were saying to ourselves, hey, you know, we feel the same way. They're saying things that we feel but have never been expressing, you know. And I heard some things there. Hey, that's right. I feel. Remember I told you I didn't relate very well. I was very lonely and lonesome because I was internalizing all this stuff instead of, you know, speaking out and being that kind of thing. And so there was a Japanese fellow, I forgot his name now, and he was in the county human relations department. And he called on Roy and some others, social workers working in the agencies, to form a position paper under the auspices of the Office of Human Relations to begin to identify issues impacting the Asian Pacific community. So he asked Roy to get some people together to talk about this, and he asked me if I wanted to be part of that group. And I said, oh yeah, that sounds very interesting. So, okay. So we got a group together, And we got a hold of I think it was Harry Kitano at UCLA, who was in the School of Social Work at that time, or School of Social Welfare, or Social Psychology, or whatever. So we identified each of the different Asian groups, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Pacific Islander, Filipino. And so we, in the Filipino group, each one of us wrote in committee, wrote position paper. That was in the late 60s. And that came to be known as Asians Coming Together, Act 1. And then there was an Act 2, and then there was an Act 3. And then the young students were getting involved and interested in the high schools and things, and there were organizations like Yellow Brotherhood, you know, and they were bringing out the fact that there were suicides occurring among young Japanese. There were Japanese girls running away from home, becoming pregnant and things, and so we were speaking out about those issues among ourselves and trying to involve the families, and the families said, no, no, we don't want any of that. We are families, we'll take care of it, you know, kind of thing. But it was too big of a problem for families to take care of. And so we became a group just like speaking out just along the model of the blacks and the Chicanos. So we had this so-called Asian.
Do you have rallies?
People would get up and talk. We organized, and the university started to talk about getting, Asian Studies Center along with the blacks and the Chicanos and the Indian, by the way. And so I would go out, and I was no longer the withdrawn shy type.
The little girl.
I was speaking out. I was volunteering, you know. And, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, I'd say, hey, I have something to say. I want to say this, you know, and I'd say. So, but I was, because of my work, they didn't call us social workers in the district, but I was identified as a social worker in the social work community because I was getting my training from trained social workers. But the district never identified us as social workers. They called us, oh, I've been called a truant officer, I've been called a child welfare worker, I've been called an attendance worker. But finally, towards the years when I was retiring, then they called us pupil personnel workers. Finally began to give us a very positive identification. So I was part of that movement.
How did other groups perceive this movement? Other groups of people? How was this group perceived?
Well, it was perceived as something that had some identity with the others, so that today, what's happening, we're having coalition groups, you know, within the context of multiculturalism. We have common issues, but yet in a way we are different. So what we want to say, we want to retain our differences, but at the same time there are certain commonalities that we're all the same, which is the concept of multiculturalism. So what's happening now in the schools, that's what they're focusing on. And that's when the library comes in, the Filipino American Library, because along with this concept developing, Filipinos have recognized, hey, You know, we've been too quiet in the past. We've been letting people identify who we are, giving us our names. That's where the thing comes about, whether to call ourselves Filipinos with an F or a Filipino with the P, you know.
Could you explain that?
Okay. Well, so... As Filipinos have learned more about their own history, about the long years of colonization by Spain and other Western countries, and then the colonization by the United States, they have given us what our identity is. Little brown brothers, you know, who couldn't govern themselves, so we had to establish the kind of government that they should have, you know. This guy. And the Spaniards saying, hey, you know, your Filipino name is too hard for us to pronounce and too hard for us to remember, so we're going to give you another name. And so that's why Filipinos were given all these Spanish surnames, you know. And then they gave us our name, Filipinos, with an F, and we didn't even have an F in our alphabet, see. And they're defining, you know, who we are and everything. So the students, with the socially conscious leadership, were beginning to say, hey, you know, if we don't do anything, you know, they'll continue saying who we are without, you know, and we're not telling them really who we are. And so, to heck with this F business, you know, we're going to use Filipino because that's more consistent, you know, with really who we are within our alphabet and that kind of thing. So that's how the young students and the leadership have now been calling ourselves Filipino. It's the same thing as the Hispanics who are third, fourth generation, who've grown up here and they know nothing about Mexico, or and they wouldn't know how to live in Mexico. So they call themselves Chicano. The more, well, it's the same thing with the change of Filipino to Filipino. But we don't downgrade people who want to in terms of the historical sense. Say, why change it? We were called Filipinos, why not, you know, we're Filipinos. So we don't quarrel with that. You know, if they want to do that, go ahead. And so that's the basis of that thing. And so today, what's happening now, instead of this regionalism that's been transferred from the Philippines here to the United States, where the social structure here in the United States was based on where you came from.
Really?
So you had your Ilocano fiestas, you had your Visayan fiestas, you had the fiestas of the Muslims from Mindanao. And so now what they're doing is to begin to think in terms of, you know, yes, we are from different regions of the islands, but still we're from the Philippines. And so if we're going to have more of a part of this country here in the United States, we're making it our home, we want to be a part of this, you know, we have to make our, you know, make our part known too. Is, you know, it's not assimilation, it's more of an acculturation. So we keep our differences as Filipino, but we also become, you know, a part of the United States. This is the Philippine culture contributing to this, you know, this society. So as a result of that, we're getting more involved. How are we going to do that? How are we going to empower ourselves so that we can be felt as a part of this country. So the empowerment is coming politically now. More Filipinos are realizing the power of politics to get involved, because after all, that's where the decisions are being made. We're getting some being elected now in different parts of the country into the different governing bodies, the councils, and Hawaii has an assistant governor in Hawaii, for example. In the school system, more teachers are feeling that they can be more than teachers. They can, you know, empower themselves by becoming middle management. We've had some being appointed now. And so as they are, then they're inculcating into the district in the curriculum things regarding to our contributions, you know, to the U.S. the farmers that grew the crops that fed the nation, you know, when the other men went to war and you know, and things like that. And so that's what's happening right now.
I'm going to pause here for just a second.